Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your retired from business, new career in sad of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Well, I went through my list of friends and found I had no one to tell of this overwhelming clear feeling.
You are listening to Mitski. Mitski's peppy song, Should Have Been Me. It's from the new album called Laurel Hell. Somehow we've never done a Mitski podcast. We've never done a Mitski episode. It's weird. We're fixing that today. We're going to talk about Laurel Hell. We're going to talk about the cult of Mitski, the memes of Mitski. We're going to talk about the lyrics of Mitski. We're going to talk about Mitski's overall uncertainty and reluctance about engaging with all of those things. Kat Zhang from Pitchfork is going to check in with us. Kat reviewed Laurel Hell. And then Alex Jung from New York Magazine and Vulture, who interviewed Mitski in November, is going to call in to talk about that experience. But really, we're just going to take a big picture look at the arc of all that Mitski has done, dating back to the mid-2010s, to the Makeout Creek era and the Puberty 2 era. And we're going to try to understand this very signature, unusual star who has a very unconventional relationship with stardom. Let's start off. Joining us now, it's Kat Zhang from Pitchfork. Kat, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kat is assistant editor at Pitchfork, also on the TikTok beat, which we may get to, but obviously we're here to talk about Laurel Hell. Kat reviewed Laurel Hell, not a best new music, just throwing that out there. Kat, talk to me a little bit about Laurel Hell, kind of in the context of Mitski's disappearance, quote unquote, and the last album, Be the Cowboy. How did this strike you, the pivots that are happening here?
Where to start? In 2019, Mitski does a show in New York at the Summer Stage in which she says that she's going to take a kind of hiatus, and fans freak out because they think that she's going to leave the industry forever. And she's like, no, it's not going to be the case. But internally, as revealed in a profile in Rolling Stone, she had legitimately thought about quitting the music industry. Her accounts of why have, you know, gone in a couple of directions. I think the one that she is most immediately offered is just like that she felt after Be the Cowboy got her so much acclaim and attention that she felt like a sort of consumerist product and very dehumanized by the music industry. And she could kind of see herself going in this direction with music where she just keep on churning out music just for the sake of churning out music.
And she's always, for what it's worth, you know, dating back to like early Mitski breakout, you know, 2014 or 16 or whatever. It's like Mitski has never spoken particularly like romantically about the notion of being a big famous music star. Like that's never really been how she's presented to the world that those were her goals. So I can imagine certainly what happened in 2018 with Be the Cowboy and just the intensity of the fan reaction and the success of the album itself being at odds with what she wants as a human. We forget that people are humans sometimes.
At the same time, though, you might have expected that maybe Be the Cowboy would come with a sense of relief because Mitski, for her entire life, has been grinding for the pursuit of this one goal, which is to be a musician and to devote her life to making music. And, you know, at the start of her career, that meant just like really, really brutal sacrifices of just like never being able to take a break and not really having like a stable place to live and not having healthcare. And I think right before Be the Cowboy came out, she was like, I'm finally in an economic position where I can just kind of make the music that I want and that I don't have to think as much about a lot of these like economic factors. So something happened in between that statement and where she's feeling now, which is getting sucked into the machine and somehow, despite this economic freedom, not feeling like she can still do what she wants. I also think that if you read Mitski's interviews from very early on and you just kind of read a lot of her accounts of her self and her career, it seems like she just has a really brutal relationship to her craft, which is familiar to anyone whose like job is what they love. And I mean, even in that interview that she did with you in like 2016, she was kind of like, look, I've thought, you know, all the time about throwing this away, about destroying my career. If I could just be a normal person with a normal job, I would be really happy. And yet she didn't do that because, as she said in this other essay, every time that she feels horrible about music, there's like a few moments of just like a glimmer of something there. She writes a good verse or something like that, and the whole world is restored. So I think a lot of that turbulent relationship to music, to her own occupation, is very present on this record, and it's definitely one of the lyrical themes.
I hadn't read that interview that I did. You quoted it in the review, and I hadn't read it, and I went back and read it. And there's something she says in there that also really jumps out at me, where she says, it's like I'm sending out messages in bottles, but very picky and stubborn and selfish, and that I only want the right person to receive it. I want to connect, but I also want to be left alone. I mean, literally, who can relate? Like, the most who can relate thing about Mitski is both the potency of the emotional knowledge, the emotional intelligence, and also that kind of like combination of that with the slightly, I'm keeping you at arm's length at the same time as I'm trying to tell you everything, but I'm also keeping you at arm's length. That is extremely powerful and kind of like all throughout Mitski's albums and certainly in her public facing presentation as well. Laurel Hell, I'm curious what you think. You mentioned in your review finding the lyrics maybe a little bit less specific. Talk to me about the songwriting on this album.
It was funny because both in the bio for this album as well as in some interviews, she almost seemed to be disavowing the previous record. On Be the Cowboy, she sort of said explicitly, you know, I'm going to experiment with short stories and fiction because people always assume that I am just like this like raw vessel of emotion. There's no artistry to what I'm doing. And so as a kind of way of preserving myself or proving to you that I am an artist, I'm going to explore these emotions, but I'm going to explicitly tell you this is fiction. So this time around, she's like, well, that was, you know, kind of defensive of me. I don't want to keep my mask up. I just want to be real and true to myself. But A, there are still sort of like short story like songs here. And B, like on a song like I Guess, the lines are so short, there's not as much like concrete imagery as you would have seen in previous works.
I also find the songwriting slight on this record. The images don't kick quite as hard. It reminds me, it's funny when you talk about Mitski saying that she was making a pivot to, I don't know if fiction is exactly the right word, but a pivot away from the confessional on Be the Cowboy. It reminds me of the recent Taylor Swift era where she was just like, I'm, you know, the characters are not me. I'm moving away from me. And on the one hand, what that tells me is that it tells me a lot about the person who's making that choice, but it doesn't necessarily convince me that the topics or the themes of the songs are not personal. I mean, I'm of the mindset that all writing is autobiographical. For me, it's more about the intensity of the storytelling, the detail, and this album, Laurel Hell, even though it has certain moments that feel really, really punchy to me, on the big scale, does feel more at a reserve in a different way than I thought Be the Cowboy was a reserve. Like, to me, neither are as successful as Make Out Creek or Puberty 2 from a storytelling and emotional kind of like revelation way.
I would agree with that. And to what you're saying, I mean, like, you know, on Be the Cowboy, there were some pretty wrenching dynamics in the vignettes that I found really compelling. So even if it was like quote unquote fiction, it still felt true in some sense. Or, you know, like she was saying that she as a person has this kind of complex with control because she feels powerless. A lot of times she wants to feel control. And so in this case, she was experimenting with the idea of a woman who is intent on preserving that control. So, I mean, like, the role she's inhabiting is, like, pretty similar.
Right. She's not writing from the perspective of, like, a longshoreman in the 1700s.
That would be so funny, though.
That'd be great. I mean, like, that's, you know, but even if she was, there'd probably be some autobiography latched within that. Kat, can we also talk about the musical choices, right? Because there's at least a few songs here, and let's listen to one of them. Let's listen to The Only Heartbreaker for a second. There's a few songs here that lean into new wave, much more pop or pop-oriented production style than we have previously heard from Mitski. I have two questions. One, do you think that this style suits her singing style? And two, what is it about a certain generation of indie rock singers of the last, like, say, 5 to 10 years, who, when they try to do something big or different, end up landing in this territory specifically? Why is this the go-to territory? I have theories on both, but I want to hear your theories.
Okay, to answer the second one first, I don't know. I don't think they should do it. It's like...
Speak on it.
You know, it's like inevitable. Like, every indie artist is like, well, I'm going pop now. And you know what? My pop effort is like, let's go to the 80s. And like, that's what's so like frustrating about this turn to me is like, okay, I mean, to be like generous first, I get that if you are like devoted to being in the Mitski universe, it might be exciting to see her like, you know, do this because the 80s stuff is like novel within her own discography. But in the broader sort of music landscape, just how many people are doing 80s stuff? And her contribution to this field of 80s stuff is not at all that distinct. So I guess I can appreciate it if I go to like the gym or something. And I like did listen to it at the gym today. And I was like, okay, cool. But like, it doesn't do that much for me. And especially if you're like a longtime Mitski listener, and you're like really used to like the craft and artistry of previous records, like it does kind of scan as disappointment.
I hate to say it. It's cheap. it's low-hanging fruit. It's almost like you're sitting in a room and you're like, well, what is the most obvious signifier that I have scaled my ambition differently? And these choices, this kind of like, we're going to make synth pop from 1984. Like, it is the most visible thing you can do that's not like making a Guns N' Roses type record, you know? Like, it's just the most visible, obvious, like, aha, we did a shift. Almost every time that I hear someone who I have previously admired for the intimacy and smallness and textural quality of their music has tried to go big, this is the choice they've made. And I think 9 times out of 10, it's an error. That said, here is my hot take on the Mitski album. Here's my hot take. I actually think the songs that are the most like this on the Mitski album, even though I don't find them musically particularly interesting, I do think the texture of the production matches her tone and posture of vocal. There is always something a little bit reluctant about Mitski singing, and that's been true dating back to Make Out Creek, even though the stories were a lot more intense and she would howl a lot more back then. But there is something about the vocal tone that's like a little bit reticent. And I do think that reticence is kind of well suited to the iciness of that synth pop era. And so I was surprised at how good a match I thought they were. But I sense from reading a lot of the reviews, I may be in the minority on that. But I was actually pretty like, okay. I don't like love that this is happening, but I'm not mad that this is happening.
I can see it, like, but I don't think.
Pat me on the head.
I can be swayed, but I don't necessarily know if her voice is like so well suited to this palette that it discounts what we just said, which is that, you know, it still feels like a relatively anonymous contribution from Mitski.
Obviously, we don't know if Mitski's going to make 10 more albums, one more album, or zero more albums. Do you feel like, hypothetically, let's say she does make another album or two, does it feel to you like a direction that's like now part of the Mitski canon? Or is it just like, we'll look back on it 3 to 5 years from now and be like, that was weird when she had 4 new wave songs on an album. That was strange.
I do think she'll probably go a different direction for the next album. I mean, Patrick Hyland, her producer, said that she works on albums in kind of twos, which you can clearly see. So like Be the Cowboy and Laurel Hell is like the two pop albums. And then I'm sure she'll like move in another direction for the next one. Personally, I mean, well, she said that like they tried like an iteration that was like country, which I can definitely hear in like Love Me More, that, you know, it could have been like a country song. I would love to see that, but you know, up to her.
Totally agree. Let's actually listen to Love Me More, which I think is one of the better songs on this album. Now, to be fair, a country turn is probably just as cliched as a new wave turn. Like, you know, I don't want to only lambaste those who are going off and making like synth records. There are plenty of cliched evolutionary steps that a mid-career artist can make. So we don't want to unreasonably punish one kind of artist or one kind of turn. But that is a particular thing that I think has been happening the last few years. Do you think she's done?
No, I don't. I really sincerely hope that she takes a very long break, though, for her own like general well-being, because it feels like she personally keeps on going through this kind of cycle where it's like she has actualized in some ways the dream of achieving this like stature as a musician and being financially stable. And yet, there's still unhappiness. I mean, even like the choice to open for Harry Styles, there's a little bit of a question mark in my head, because if the issue is like being projected onto by like a tons of really intense fans and also being a commercial product, like I don't know if opening for Harry is like going to make anything better.
No, and I will say like maybe the I don't know if I've said this on podcast before, like one of the only times I've ever genuinely felt like deep empathy and concern for a musician about something that I was watching happening was when I saw Mitski open for Lord, I think maybe at Barclays or the Garden, maybe at the Barclays, I can't remember, Garden, something like that. And it was, you know, so early in the night and like almost nobody was there and almost nobody knew who she was. And it just like was a rough 30 minutes, you know, like it just was, it was tough. And I very much felt for her in that moment. Obviously, many years have passed. I'm sure she's a much more confident performer. She's much more well-known. I don't think that that particular scene is likely to be repeated. But I definitely, when I saw the Harry Styles news, I had like a flashback to the Lord thing and being like, ooh, okay, I want better for her. That's my hope. But maybe opening for Harry Styles, maybe that's low pressure in a way. Like maybe we're reading it wrong, because you're done at like 8:15 and then that's the night. You're just like, okay, I did my job, the check cleared, and, you know, now I get to go have dinner in Brussels or wherever the hell you are.
Yeah, sure.
I'm trying to spin this, Kat.
Well, she did write that one essay kind of reviewing Harry's record, and...
Oh, I didn't see that. What did she say?
She was kind of like somewhat of a romantic essay in which she was talking about Harry as this figure being the sort of like boy that you pine over. So kind of like touching on the sort of symbol of Harry and then reviewing, like, I forgot which record this was, but this was about in 2017. And I think one of the lines that she ended it was like, you know, if he read this review, he'd probably be weirded out, but it's not about him anyway.
Do you think that's why he picked her for tour? Like, he did read it and was like, I want to take this person on the road with me?
I would doubt it, but I do think maybe it would be exciting for her to be close to someone who, in some way, she's mythologized a little bit. I think, you know, her dynamic to Harry is interesting to think about also in the context of, like, her fans, like, dynamic with her, where it's like, she is clearly stated in numerous instances that she feels like such unease with the way that people kind of project onto her and, you know, how they treat her as the symbol. But also, like, I think she does understand it too. And I feel like in past interviews when she's talked about it, you know, it's a bit more balanced where she's like, yeah, you know, it's like kind of uncomfortable, but also like I, as a person, crave symbols. Like that's why I like Lana Del Rey. And also like you want people to like love you. And then you're like, wait, no, like I don't want to be known. But then like they know you and then you're like, wait, and I want you to think I'm awesome. And it's like a little bit more of like a push and pull where she's like negotiating the projection stuff. But now I think a lot of the like narrative in profiles and interviews is basically Mitski fans are like the most sort of demanding parasocial people out there.
Not untrue. I mean, look, we were joking a little bit before we started recording about Mitski talk and the feverishness of the online relationship that people have with Mitski as an idea. And I think a lot of what Mitski has talked about her own relationship to fame is, I think, really, you know, it's the true sense of being commodified, which is like the relationship is with the idea, not with the entity. It's with the idea. And I definitely think the way that I see people reacting or using Mitski as kind of like a proxy for emotional breakdown or emotional trauma on the internet is very real. And that's got to be strange. You linked to something that I had not seen in your review, which is Mitski reacting to tweets. And I guess she's not on social, or at least she says she's not on social. Maybe she's got a Finsta or a spam. Tag me. Let me know if anybody knows what it is. Tag me in. Mitski, tag me in. But there's one in the middle of that video where the person is like, something about sad girl, blah, blah, blah. And Mitski's like, the sad girl thing is over. Like, let's retire it. Like, I don't want to be associated with it anymore. And I can imagine if you have seen that said about you 100,000, 10,000 times, whatever your own relationship with that idea might be, you're going to be drained. You're going to be like, I want nothing to do with this. Even if you sort of agree with it, you kind of don't want to be hemmed in and bound by how people are labeling you that way. That's got to be fatiguing. And I think Mitski seems like a person that's trying to actively seek being fatigued by the kind of like side effects of the work.
And I do think that TikTok makes it worse because it's very trendy on TikTok to basically, it's almost like uncool to state that you're like happy. It's like very cool to be like, I'm so depressed and I listen to XYZ artists and do XYZ thing. And like, here's my identity tidily encapsulated in this, like just a series of like consumer choices.
You think Mitski has a spam TikTok?
No, I don't think so.
Really? Like low-key, like I low-key think she does. Not to search for herself. Like I don't think she's like doing it to secretly like spy on herself. I think she's just doing it because like she seems like a person who'd get a kick out of just seeing people on TikTok.
Maybe she has someone in her life who is like on TikTok and then like they send her like the good stuff.
Right, but because we don't know anything about her life, we'll never know if that's the case.
Yeah.
Part of the narrative of this album is that she was not aware that she owed her label another album and then somehow was made aware of that. Does that feel real to you? Does that feel narrativized?
I believe the sort of like, I thought I was going to quit. And then, you know, I realized that I still have another album to put out. I think the question that people have been trying to circle is this an album that she made to just like appease the label and kind of get it out of the way, which I don't think it is, because I don't think she would have promoted it and toured it this heavily if that were the case. But I don't know. It's kind of intriguing to think about. And I've also seen it from the fan perspective where it's like, should I listen to this album if it feels like Mitski was kind of coerced into like making this thing?
Right. Although, like, I guess in my heart, I don't believe Mitski was coerced into making it. I also find it a little bit stretching the bounds of credulity to be like, nobody knew that she had to make this album. Like, that to me feels like a flourish. That's like a press release flourish, kind of. It doesn't really feel I don't know. I know like all the deadlines I have going on any given day. And Mitski is like more meticulous than I am. Like, it just seems unlikely that there'd be like this thing hovering that would come as a surprise.
I believe that she maybe could have like forgotten a little bit and then like been reminded, but I don't think it was like a permanent thing. I mean, maybe something that you're getting at is also like, it just seems like there are a lot of artists where there's like this big profile and it's like, I was about to quit music. And then I came out with this album. And like the framing of it creates this feeling of scarcity, which then like drives up interest in the album.
Absolutely. 100%. It is a convenient narrative for an artist about whom people feel feverish to say, we were considering not giving you anything, but instead we have given you something. And the kind of like all the details are like filigree. They kind of like are immaterial to the fundamental thing, which is like, could have gone away, but we didn't. Kat Zhang, I appreciate you coming through podcast and being the cowboy here today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Let's listen to a little bit of Working for the Knife, one of the more evocative songs on Laurel Hell.
The New York Times is always putting me on to things.
I was reading about grandma's road tripping all over China.
I just wanted to know more. I wanted to understand more.
I talked to people about what they cooked last night, and I send them a recipe from the cooking app.
The brown butter Brussels sprout gnocchi.
Those little like perfect moments of surprise and delight.
I had a push notification about great white sharks on the literal beach that I was standing on.
There was an article about like saffron dryers, a village that dries saffron.
I just found it to be so visually beautiful.
The Times makes me interested in things I didn't even know I was interested in.
The New York Times keeps me curious.
And that's what I love about it.
Find out how the New York Times can fit into your life
at nytimes.com/life.
Joining me now, it's Alex Jung, features writer at New York Magazine and Vulture. Alex, welcome to Popcast. This is your journey. Welcome.
No, I think it's your journey, actually.
Well, as longtime listeners know, it most certainly is my journey. Alex interviewed Mitski on this album cycle. We're going to talk about that. Before we get into it, though, I do want to say, if you are not reading Alex, definitely need to be reading Alex, one of the most empathetic profile writers out there working right now. So go dive back into Alex's work if you are not familiar with it. Let's get into Mitski. And part of the reason that I wanted to talk to you specifically about is specifically in the context of like your other profile writing, you work with subjects who are on a whole range of emotional transparency. And this seemed like perhaps a subject of someone who was not always giving what you are seeking to get. And that is part of the Mitski narrative, right?
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about, like, I interviewed Mitski in 2016, when I think just the notion of doing a lot of press was still, like, relatively new and fresh. And even then, there was reluctance and kind of uncertainty about how much to really talk about and what parts of her life should be made available to the press and to the public. And it seems it's very much still on her mind.
I mean, I think she's probably just a naturally private person. And I think that those people exist even in our friendships or our circles who are purely not famous people. And I you know, I'm curious to hear what you thought of her when you talked to her back in 2016, because that's a very different time in her life. And I'm pretty sure I read that piece because I try to read everything before I talk to someone.
So leading up to Puberty 2, which is, depending on how you think of Mitski albums, the second one or the fourth one, that's when the narrativization of Mitski starts. And I can tell, okay, so there's something she said in that interview where she says, I'm learning to be open in certain aspects of my life to almost create a red herring so that other stuff can remain private. Sometimes I feel more like myself on stage as a performer than I do off stage. So even at that time, she's making very, very, very strategic calculations about how much of herself she can keep to herself. And this comes up again in your interview where she's talking about, I assume it's the European press tour on this album, or was it on Be the Cowboy, where she felt like it was almost assaultive, the nature of those interviews.
I think the line was she felt like a toilet. It's an incredible image, you know?
Yeah. And frankly, as someone who is fundamentally sympathetic to what the wages of celebrity are, like, I know that being famous is work. I know that doing an interview with me or with you, no matter how smooth that interview is, it's labor. I understand that, and I'm sympathetic to it. You just so rarely hear that person talk about it. So frankly, you want to, as a journalist and as a subject, you kind of want to be like, yes, we're in this extended dance with each other where I'm doing the best version of what I do and you're doing the best version of what you do. And we're going to come out the other side and feel great about it. But that's not really always how it goes. So tell me about how she spoke about being on the receiving end beyond that imagery. And then also the actual nature of the discourse that you guys had on this day in Nashville together.
By this point, post Be the Cowboy, there really is like a narrative about, like, a journalist narrative and also a fan narrative about the mysteriousness of Mitski. Every sort of profile that I read did some iteration of, you know, she's deeply private and averse to press and talking about her personal life, right? And I guess going into it, I sort of knew that that would happen. And I don't want to reproduce the same exact thing, but I thought it would at least be maybe interesting to try to get to a point of understanding why that exists.
Right. If you can't sort of undo it, you can at least understand it and explain it.
Right. Like, let's do the meta version of this where we're having a conversation about conversations. You know, we're doing a press interview about press interviews.
No, and sometimes that's all you're left with. You know, you interview enough famous people or enough people who have been down the road of them being narrativized. Some people really take to it and some people really retreat from it. And you just, as a journalist, have to learn how to craft your narrative on top of whichever narrative you're presented on the day of the interview.
And it was ultimately what I ended up trying to do. And however, you know, it was a total failure probably, but was to at least give the reader a feeling of what it's like to be with her, because she does talk incredibly vaguely, but she will answer your question. You know, so you'll ask her questions and she won't really answer them, but she will say really intense things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%.
Like, you know, like the toilet stall thing where you're just like, oh my God, that is such a vivid image, right? And I believe you, right? Like, I think that that is 100% true for her. And so I guess that's sort of what I ultimately was trying to do with the piece, was just to, at the very least, make you understand what it feels like to talk to her and spend time with her. Which is also what she does in her music, right? Like, I think she's really good at this compact, muscular imagery that, like, really can sort of take you on a journey, punch you in the face without too many specifics around, I don't know, narrative or biography.
Well, and it's interesting because I think something that comes up in your interview and also came up when I talked to her in 2016 is this tug of war. It's really the tug of war between, I acknowledge that I am sharing, like, dispositionally and professionally, I am sharing. That is the premise of this entire thing. And yet, don't come too close. Don't come too close. Don't do that. And that is something that she was keyed in on. And it's funny that you talk about the way that she will answer a question, right? Because I'm sure you've interviewed people who will find every elision possible to not actually answer a question. They'll talk to you, but they're not really answering you. They'll talk around. But Mitski answers. But I think as someone who is a little bit more reluctant, a little bit more private, and I think I can relate to this personally as someone who likes to be direct with my thoughts and feelings, sometimes you find yourself being direct and being like, wow, that's draining. I want to do less of that. I don't want to lie, but I just need to put up a wall at a certain point and be like, okay, I've given you all I can give right now. And it does seem like that is how she is handling press, broadly speaking.
Totally. There was a line that I had in an old draft where I basically called her Bartleby because she would just prefer not to, you know, like, you know, you could ask her a question and she was just like, she'll be like, I don't know. I'll have to think about that. Like, you know, she's being honest-ish, maybe, right?
Right.
But she would simply prefer not to answer the question. And that's her right. You know, that's also
right.
Her
and also, it's like, we know on the receiving end, no information is information. That's a kind of information. You know, it's not maybe necessarily what you set out on the flight down to get, but it is the information. You also, there's one specific word in your piece that really jumped out at me, which is you, and it was referring, I think, to her live shows. You use the word corseted. And I thought that was just so spot on because it is wrapped very tight, all of it. It's wrapped tight. And we're used to a certain amount of exuberance and almost like irrationality from people who exist at this level of success in the music business. And that is absolutely not what's happening here.
And I think that tension is interesting, though, because I think like a corset, you can sort of feel it, right? Like you can feel all the pressure building inside and you know that it exists and it does come out in this very specific way on her terms, I think, for the most part, but it's still there. The restraint is still there. And I think that that's like true for her in general, is just a sense of power, right? Like what she is giving, what she is owed, what she's owing someone. And I felt that very much also during the interview, right? Like that this journalistic exchange was also one that was, you know, rife with power in her mind.
Coming from your perspective, where I know often in some of your profiles, you know, you have multiple sessions with people. They're these kind of like long extractive exercises. It's interesting you guys went in a cave here. Did this feel different for you in the process of your work with someone who did not wish to be extracted from?
I guess I sort of made up my mind after that day that we spent together. And, you know, there's a chance of, you know, at that point where I'm like, do I do more interviews? Do I try to get more time? Do I do a bunch of secondaries? Do I do this kind of like, you know, fully fleshed out Mitski profile? Or do I go this other route, acknowledge the discomfort, the boundaries, the limits, and write about that? And I sort of ultimately decided not to do the full-fledged profile, in part because it had been done, right? Like other people had tried it, they failed, I think, right? They were unsuccessful at it. And so I didn't feel that it was worth it. And I also just kind of felt with her that you wouldn't get anywhere. Like it just didn't feel like it would be a good story ultimately, and that everything that I needed to know had happened.
Do you get the sense, going back to the idea of power, do you get the sense that that framing is also present in terms of Mitski's relationship with her fans, which seems to have become unusually intense in recent years? Because even in the Puberty 2 era, even after that album had come out and was a success, I would not describe the nature of Mitski fan as quite as intense and particular as it seems to have become in the last like 2 to 3 years. You know, the idea of Mitski being this kind of like proxy for, I'm a mess, I'm putting it all out there, you know, I'm melting down. It's just like Mitski becomes a shorthand for that. How aware of that do you sense that she is? And what do you feel like her relationship was when you guys talked about it?
To her fans, basically?
Yeah, yeah.
I think she's scared of them a little bit.
Who can relate?
Like, I think she finds the intensity and the idea that they think they know her to be scary. And I think, like, for her, what she has had to do is detach herself from whatever conception they have of her, and that becomes a repository for all of their projections, fantasies, anxieties, and that isn't her. And I think that's kind of what she has emotionally tried to compartmentalize. I don't know how successful that is for anyone, but I think that that's the general attempt. She's scared that fans would try to get to know her, find her, meet her.
I mean, they would. I mean, let's just keep it a buck. They absolutely would.
Totally.
like even that bit in your story where you're like, do you have a pet? Like, I'd rather not say, which like seems on paper, you're like, damn, that seems odd. But in reality, it's like, of course you would never say, because what if the pet's name is water bottle? And then someone Googles water bottle cat Nashville. And then they find like some, you know, it's like the internet is a dark and scary place and anything is findable.
And these are like younger people. So I think Mitski, one becomes a Mitski fan at a certain point in your life often. And I think that that is an internet savvy person. So, I think that she is aware of that, right? That there's a lot of very intense, maybe depressive teens who really love her and think that she's the only one who could understand them.
Something she said when I talked to her in 2016, which feels prescient looking back on it, was she was just like, I know for a fact that I'm problematic. I shouldn't be looked to for any kind of guidance. I have to go out and consciously say, I'm a person. I can't be a role model. I'm not a representative of anything. And obviously, this is also, she's talking about race here, in addition to kind of like being a role model for how to behave in the world. And she said, I have to consciously go out and do that, which is to say, I reject it, or else it's going to be put upon me. And so for a person who felt that way, even in 2016, the intensity of the parasocial stuff happening in 2021 and 2022, I would want to throw my phone in a cave. That's the only logical response.
Especially if you are someone who does not seek fame and does not wish to exist in that space in that way.
Correct. But she sat for an interview with you. She sat for a Rolling Stone interview. This album is not without its rollout conventions.
Right. Because I did ask her, I was like, you could just not do it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Just don't do it and just release the album. And she felt that she couldn't. She felt that she was still obligated to the industry and obligated to participate in the cycle. And I don't know how true that is, right?
But I kind of, yeah, I disagree. I think what you're saying is right. I think that there, Mitski to me is in the category of artists who could just go away and come back in 2-3 years and just be like, here's an album, like write a long Instagram caption and just be like, this is what I've been up to. This is where I'm at. Don't come find me. Here's my record. Maybe see you in a couple of years. Love you. Love you. And thank you. Here's the ticket. Here's the link to buy tickets for the tour.
Right. Hags.
Yeah. Right. That's how it feels. And maybe, look, maybe moving forward, that will be her approach if she continues to make records and tour. But I agree with that because I do think, not that there's no joy in this album cycle, kind of like in these kinds of tasks, she must find some joy. There was a thing where she was reading tweets and memes about her, and she seemed like happy to do that. I was like, I watched that video and I was like, oh, you seem like amused by this.
Right, right. Because that's probably the only time she's read Twitter this whole...
Absolutely. Yes, if I only had to read Twitter once every 3 years, I would probably find it pretty amusing too.
Right.
Damn. Maybe I'd... Okay. Maybe I'll just go delete my Twitter after we're done with this conversation and then come back for 3 years.
I know. Sometimes I'm like, we should all just do this, maybe.
Real talk. Real talk. Talk about things that are extractive without reward. Jeez.
Right. We are just performing this emotional labor for Twitter all the time and for I'm not sure what.
Dark AF. Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay. So walking into the interview and then walking out, was there anything that happened or anything that was said that made you reassess whatever biases or preconceived ideas or expectations that you had when you were flying down there?
It sort of ultimately came down to the whole, you know, how much can we talk about things in specifics thing for me, you know? And I was trying my best to say, we can just have a conversation. And she very quickly was like, no, we can't.
And you were like, but the thing is, we totally just can. Like, that's the thing is, what's funny about that is that we actually totally can. And she was like, and what's funny about that actually, we totally can.
Because I'm like, you know, I'm just me, you know? I'm just like, you know, we're just kicking here. We're just on a road trip. Right.
And she was like, yeah, I don't do that. I'm not on whatever part of social media that is. Yeah, we don't. There's no Kiki here. We don't,
right,
yeah.
Right.
She's like looking it up on Urban Dictionary. She's like, what is that? Like, no, we're not doing that.
Right. She was just like, you are not you. You are the world. I do remember that line that she said.
It's heavy.
Yeah, and I was like, that's true, I guess. You know, ultimately, I was like, when it comes down to it, yeah. So I think that's when I decided to hang it up flat screen.
Okay, to step outside of the specifics of this interview, just to talk about journalistic process a little bit, sometimes we get in the weeds a little bit on this show. I've never really had a subject say that to me. You're not you, you're the world. And obviously, journalist and the murderer and all that fun stuff, it's like part of it is you're developing covert intimacy. And to have someone like so very plainly turn it on you and say, I see what you're doing. I understand even why you're doing it. And yet I do not accede to what you're doing. When you took that home with you, did you think about that in the context of all your other work and how you present in your other interviews and how you show up for other stories? Was that something that stuck with you or is ringing around in your head a little bit even still?
I don't fully subscribe to the, you know, Janet Malcolm, the journalist is always a like a thief and a con man in that sense. But I am aware of the...
And RIP Janet Malcolm.
Right. Yeah. Honestly, truly, what a writer. But I'm aware of the power that exists even when you're talking to a celebrity as a journalist. And I think it's, for me, interesting to keep that in mind. And I think for certain people, that can become more part of the narrative that you're telling. But, you know, obviously with Mitski, I felt like it was predominant. I had written much more about that sort of tension in our relationship, an original draft that was cut by other people. But
you want to name names? Go ahead, name names. It's safe.
You know, I think maybe it feels too writery, like inside baseball, to sort of like ad nauseum discuss the relationship at length. So I understand why it was cut.
Yeah, and I personally, as a reader who is also does this work, like it's not that I don't trust the person who is the writer. It's not that I'm not interested in the writer's perspective, but I think that there is a time and place to kind of like go down like a 1,000-word first person hole. And often it is not when you are trying to tell the story of another person.
No. And sometimes it's just like, okay, it just sounds like you didn't get the goods. So shut up about it. You know?
They're like, Alex, actually, you're telling on yourself here is what you're doing.
Right. You're actually just saying you're a bad journalist.
And then you're milking it for 1,000 words. Right. So what you're telling me is you can write a lot of words, you just can't get the goods. Okay, I see what you're doing here. Maybe let's dial that back a little bit.
Yeah, maybe work on your interviewing skills and then come back to it.
So the headline, the takeaway is Mitski made me go back into the woodshed and work on my interview skills.
Right.
Did talking to her reframe or change your feelings about her music and what you're listening for and what you hear coming out of the songs?
No, I guess for me, it was sort of like seeing those parallels between like that quality that she has, you know, that corseted quality that we were talking about. Like, I think it was kind of sensing that in person and how she is in that space as a public person, right? Even though it is just the two of us, she is acting as a public person in that moment. And I think that is kind of what I sort of noticed more in the performances that I would watch, you know, when I would listen to the music, you know, like when she did her NPR Tiny Desk and she's just like so low key. And then she does the Kill Me Jerusalem like line and she's just like screaming it into her guitar. You know, like I think that it's that kind of those moments where I sort of felt like I understood the back and forth at least, or the ambivalence between wanting to sort of like unleash and put this like high intense emotion out there, but also keep the important parts to yourself.
When I think about the last two albums, I know that Be the Cowboy is like the breakthrough album, but to me it's the least successful of the Mitski albums. And these last two albums feel less invested than the first two, or the third and fourth, again, depending how you think of it. And I feel like some of that distance and reluctance that she's displaying as a celebrity is creeping into the songcraft. And so when I hear these songs, to me, they're kind of a piece with these kind of details that pop up in these press opportunities. And I see someone who is trying to reconcile how to be constantly while not in fact being public.
I wonder if that's also the slide towards more like pop and a kind of commercial sound too, I think that's interesting. That would be interesting to talk to her about.
next cycle. We're building up the questions now. We'll drop them all next album cycle. Alex, man, I appreciate you coming through and chopping it up with us today.
Yeah, of course.
And I appreciate also, like I said, if everybody's not reading Alex, get involved. Go read him.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
That is our show. Thank you to Kat. Thank you to Alex. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. Let me know what you think about Mitski. Someone in the podcast Facebook group, I believe, coined the phrase or the term Mitski, which is rude, although I get it. I understand. But anyway, I think that came from the Facebook group. So shout out to whoever did that. It was funny. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. Let's go out with another song from Laurel Hell, one which had my favorite title and some really powerful imagery. It is called That's Our Lamp. Personally, I just buy my own lamps, but that's our lamp. Looking up into our